You're listening to Speaking of Racism, the podcast dedicated to frank, honest, and respectful discussions about race and racism in the U.S. I'm your host, Jen Kinney. Pull up a chair and let's talk. Special thanks to Grapes for the music. The song is I Don't Know, featuring Jay Lang. So today I am welcoming April Harder to the show. She is a licensed clinical social worker and the inventor of the racist signature method. Welcome to the show, April.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm really excited to have you on. I came across you very recently through Instagram, and what you're doing stands out to me quite a bit because you have this very intentional program and process. So I would love to find out more about you, what your story is, how you created this program, what goes into this, and just get some ideas from you on that.
Wonderful. Well, you know, the funny thing about this is that I never expected to do this. You know, I had no plan on doing this. It was not something that years ago, I'm going to create this. It all just kind of fell in my lap in a way. And it all started with Charlottesville because I was I was seriously traumatized, racially traumatized with the whole incident in Charlottesville.
Yeah.
And I think, of course, the whole country and the whole world was. And I really didn't know what to do with myself. I can look at hindsight 2020, I can look back and go, man, I surely was racially traumatized at the time. And in that trauma, I was angry with white people. I was angry with the racism in America. And what are we going to do about it? We need to do something. I needed to purge. I needed to get things off my chest. And also as a social worker, I felt like I got to do something about this because I became a social worker to deal with social injustice on a mass scale.
Mm.
So I thought to myself, okay, I'm going to write something. And I wrote a Medium article that ended up having like 1.2 million viewers.
Wow.
It went viral.
Awesome.
And this was not too long after Charlottesville. And actually, we're talking like probably 1 or 2 days. Like I just needed to purge. Yeah. It was just hard. Because you're seeing the April now that is very much healed very much from racial trauma versus the April that wrote that article. And yeah, there were 1.2 million views. And that's a pretty amazing accomplishment. But the question was, but was I really leading? Mm. I wasn't, because I was coming from a place of trauma. In fact, I made a point to add an addendum to this article and say, you know, at that time, just so you know, I was in racial trauma big time and traumatized. And so I was writing content from a place of trauma.
Mm.
And so the white people that responded were, they were very supportive, but looking hindsight now with my program, they were reacting in saviorism and racist projection. But at that time, I felt very righteous, very indignant and angry and depressed and sad, which there's nothing wrong with feelings. But when you're emotionally compromised like that, coming from a place of racial trauma, it's the other thing is how emotionally compromised are you when you're writing that? And then what kind of influence is it going to have?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this article really reflected the voice of the people, but it wasn't coming from a healthy place. It was not coming from a healthy place. So at that time, I wasn't ready to lead this movement. I certainly wasn't, because I was heavy into racial trauma. But I tell you what it did do. It was a sign that I needed to do something with racism. Mm-hmm. Now that, looking back on it, was like a sign from the universe, like, oh, you need to be doing something related to racism. So then after I wrote the article, I got contacted by TED and by the Huffington Post. And TED interviewed me like, I think twice. And then they chose not to, you know, work with me. And I was like, oh, okay, you know, it is what it is. Then I got published on the Huffington Post and like their blog entries. So that was kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I still felt like it wasn't enough. Let me show you a timeline. So we're talking, I'm 40 now. I just turned 40 this year. But in 2016, I was 37. I had moved from Texas. I lived all 37 years of my life in Texas.
Mm.
And then I did a radical move. I moved from Texas to Colorado. And that was a huge thing. I mean, most people by that age are settled and they know where they're living and they're comfortable, whatnot. No, like I just up and moved in 2016.
Yeah.
And I had always wanted to move out of Texas, but I was waiting to get my clinical license. So I've been, most of my career, I've been in Texas, was called the LMSW, but now I'm a clinical social. I've been a clinical social worker, which means that I can have my own private practice and practice psychotherapy now for about 3 years. So in May, it'll actually, on the 21st of May, it'll be exactly 3 years that I got my clinical license. So in 2016, I said, okay, cool. I am going to move to Colorado because Colorado, it's more expensive to live there compared to Texas. And this clinical license is really going to help me, give me a sure economic footing moving into a higher, you know, a higher, more expensive place to live, basically. This is like my little safety net. So that was kind of the big thing. If I get this clinical license, then I can move to Colorado. And as soon as I did, I was like, okay, boom. So I got my clinical license in May and moved to Colorado in July. So it was only a few months.
Wow.
And so then, back to the timeline. So then a year later, that's when Charlottesville hit. So I had been a year into private practice. And in that year of private practice, what I learned moving from Texas to Colorado was how the white psychotherapists didn't know that they were committing microaggressions in their therapy session.
Oh, yeah.
And I was a new psychotherapist. I still am, but I'm a social worker. I've been a social worker for a long time. So the thing about social workers is that when you're an LMSW, you're still doing therapy with people, but you always have to kind of have a supervisor. But when you are the LCSW, you are the supervisor. You are the one that's leading and directing all of that. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of like, I went from like a, I don't know, like the equivalent in, I went from like being an RN to a nurse practitioner, basically. Mm-hmm. So where you can diagnose and all that kind of stuff. Well, so the year into private practice, so then how did I even know that these microaggressions were occurring? Well, first things first, I was getting calls because I put my name and everything on Psychology Today.
Right.
For marketing and all that good stuff. But then I kept on getting calls from POC, particularly Black women in the state of Colorado, saying, you know, I really do actually like my white therapist for the most part. But, you know, every time I talk about the racism I go through, the white therapist tells me, well, maybe you're just imagining things.
Ugh.
And I was like, whoa. I was like,
wow.
Hold up. That is very unprofessional behavior.
Right.
That's like, really that was actually the first thing that hit my mind. Like, this is countertransference. This is unprofessional behavior. Like,
yeah.
What? So when it happened once, I was like, okay. But then I kept on getting calls. We're talking up to 10 or 15 calls, same thing. And I was like, okay, this, I think I need to investigate this. So, I also started networking with, you know, with the clinicians in Colorado Springs, where I live, which is about an hour south of Denver.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started networking with the clinicians in Denver. And, you know, the political climate is very different between Denver and Colorado Springs. Colorado Springs is very conservative. It is, if you've seen the movie, The Black Klansman, this is where Ron Stallworth was.
Yeah.
The police officer. Who
got, yes.
You know, the Klan. I am in that city. And so, and then Denver is very liberal, right? And so, so very different perspective. So I started talking to the POC psychotherapists and the white psychotherapists in Colorado Springs. And both of them just kind of had a very passive kind of, oh, that's just the way it is. I'm like, well, but that's not good enough.
Right.
We just be like, well, this is the way it is. And we just kind of bend over and take it. I'm like, no, we need to improve our profession,
right,
and make sure that we do the best, because these people's lives are, in our hands. Yeah. So I finished, you know, I talked to, you know, I not interviewed, but I basically kind of interviewed. I chatted with some folks and schmoozed and whatnot. Got their perspective. Like I said, they're kind of like, oh, that's the way it is. I'm like, no, people's health is on the line. Then I talked to my colleagues in Denver. They had very different perspective. And so it depended on their race. So the white folks that were psychotherapists in Denver, you had the ones that were totally oblivious to how they were acting in microaggressions. And then you had the ones that were really, now looking back on it, they thought they were allies, and they are trying to be allies, but they were acting in performative allyship, which is like saviorism.
Right.
So when I started talking about stuff, they're like, "Ooh, let me save you and see what you can do." And then the other white folks were like, "Oh, I don't know what you're talking about." So they were in what I call racist denial. Mm-hmm. And so all defense mechanisms, right? Two different types. One looks better than the other, but they're both defense mechanisms. And then the POC. Now, this was really interesting. So the POC psychotherapists in Denver were like, "Hey, let me tell you the scoop." And I was like, "Yeah, what is the scoop?" They're like, "The white people in Colorado, period, and just like the psychotherapists, like they really don't get it." And it's because we live in such a white state and they're very sheltered. It's, "Oh, well, that makes sense. That makes sense." And they said, "Yeah, you know, like we would get our master's degrees or get our doctorates, you know, to become licensed psychotherapists. And even in school, because these people like were born and raised here." And they're like, they're giving me a perspective of what it's like to be POC born and raised here, who are psychotherapists. And they're like, "Let me tell you about my school situation. I mean, the professors were, you know, reacting to our talks about racism in microaggressions. The students were backing the professors." And it was just a really, really hostile, racist environment. I was like, "Oh my gosh." I was like, "Whoa." Like, I had never understand that I'm from the South and racism is everywhere and it's a lot more overt.
Right.
But I'd never experienced this level of racism. And I have to tell you point blank and straight up, I really, in my experience, feel that Colorado is more racist than even the state of Texas. It's just that in Texas, it's more in your face.
Right.
But Colorado is like covert.
Yeah.
Which, think about it, when you put something in the closet and it stinks, it festers, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So it actually like festers. So like the denial is stronger in Colorado versus Texas. They're like, "Yeah, I'm a racist." You know, like this right. is how I feel. You know, at least they know, you know, in Colorado, mm-hmm. they react in racist ways, but they don't know. So what you don't know will, it's knowledge is power, right? So like, you don't even know you're acting like that. It was a totally, you know, they say culture shock. It was culture shock for me. I was just, and traumatizing. So not only did I experience rape, and I also experienced more racism in Colorado, particularly Colorado Springs, than I have ever experienced in my life. Hmm. And so, and I mean, ironically, people would yell out and scream at me.
Really?
And so, oh yeah, it was real bad.
Wow.
Like three or four times. So I was the victim of racism. I was watching, you know, potential clients experience racism with their therapist. You know, I was really doing a social work assessment overall, being from the victim perspective, as well as secondary trauma I was witnessing, as well as, so just a whole microcosm of stuff I was taking in, right? Mm. Whole assessment personally, and then looking from the outside, you know, inside out, whatnot. And then I still didn't understand what I needed to get healing for my trauma. And like what pretty much 99.9% of POC do, it don't matter what your background is. We're taught in society when it comes to bigotry, "Oh, we just need to get right into activism right now. We just need to get right into activism." So I did what I was taught. Not only by society, but even as a social worker, you need to just get right into grassroots organizing. So what I did was I created a Facebook group for psychotherapists in the state of Colorado, so that we could start addressing this problem. Well, I really, really didn't know what I was doing.
That's
you know, I wanted to do it, but did I really understand what it was going to take? No, it is a total learning process. Mm-hmm. And so eventually, the group got bigger and bigger. And then I was like, you know, I don't feel like I'm making enough headway. I'm not really getting enough engagement from these white psychotherapists or psychotherapists in the state of Colorado, period. So let me see if I open this up to the whole United States. Heck, let me just open it up to the whole world. Mm. So I opened it up and it ended up eventually getting like 800 members. That's pretty good. Like yeah. 800 members. And so, but there was drama. So like with the 800 members, what ended up happening was that there was a big time interracial conflict. So we're talking like the POC. So the white psychotherapists were like, "I came here to learn. POC therapists, you teach me." And then the POC therapists, some of them said, no, I'm not here to teach you. And then also some of the other POCs, yeah, let me help you. Let me help you. Mm-hmm. So in that whole situation, looking back on it now with my method, I basically engaged in a situation I wasn't prepared in because I wasn't healed from my racial trauma. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand what was going to happen. So after all that went down, I said, I got to make a safer space for POC in this space. This is not good because these white people, they don't know they're doing this. Mm-hmm. So they need help. And so I said, well, let me just go online. Let me give them resources. Like they're struggling. They're having issues. They're acting out racist ways, which, you know, eventually I had to filter it to where the only way you could join as a white person is if you had done some type of personal work, you know, so that you're not coming into the group, you know, expecting the emotional and mental labor of the POC in the group all the time. And so I did that. But when I tried to find resources, Jen, guess what? I found some resources, but in my gut, and again, I didn't have the methodology. And this is like in, started the group in July of 2017. And then this is now 2018, right? Like the end of 2017, early 2018, because 2018 is when I started coaching. But before I started coaching, I was like, let me find resources. And so, yeah, I found resources, but they were really, in my viewpoint, very shallow. We didn't really get to the emotional problems going on with this racism. And I'm like, I don't really feel this is going to do anything. I was like, you know, I'm not seeing anything good. And right. So as a social worker, I'm like, well, okay, fine. You know, if I can't find any resources, I'm just going to have to roll my sleeves up and do it myself. And that's what I mean when I say I didn't intend to do this.
Yeah.
So I started coaching in 2018. Like it was like, I think it was April or May or something like that, almost exactly a year ago. And I did it at an hourly rate. And I thought I knew what I was doing because I just did what I saw done and what I knew could be done, which is here, white person, this is how you're, you know, white person. Okay. This is how I feel terrible. And could you show me where I'm acting as racist? And then I would point that out and then all seemed fine. And then the next time I met with them, they literally repeated the exact same thing. Hmm. And I'm like, oh, the white folk that I was coaching at an hourly rate. And I'm like, I don't understand. I showed this white person exactly what happened, what they did that was racist, how it was racist, broke it all down. And they're repeating the same thing, the same type of thing, but a different, just the same response, different scenario. And these are the white psychotherapists. So I started, you know, helping at the time only white psychotherapists. Hmm. And so, so I was dumbfounded. And one day one of my clients said, and I mean, this kind of question is asked all the time to the influencers of anti-racism and all people who do anti-racism work that are POC. I don't know. It's asked all the time. And the question is, when will I start to get better? I don't understand. When will I start to get better? I've been going to coaching and I don't understand. So my white clients were kind of like, well, I want to be a good white ally and I don't want to hurt my clients, but I don't understand what I'm doing wrong. Hmm. And I'm sitting there and I remember like the first time that question was asked, I said, what do I say? What do I do? What? Because I didn't know. That's the truth. And looking back on it, I thought it was the truth. And I remember feeling this inner conflict, like, how dare this white person ask this question? How dare they want a solution? You're the problem. So you need to figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and that's the trauma in me coming out angry. You know, this is like my trigger. So I was being triggered in my coaching sessions.
Wow.
Okay. And I didn't realize I was being triggered because, again, this was a new pioneering field. Even if, let's say I play devil's advocate and I asked and I told myself, April, you should have gotten clinical supervision for that to see if you're going into counter transference, having issues with some of these clients. But here's the problem, Jen. Nobody was doing what I was doing. So there's nobody else to turn to help.
Yeah, it's like, how could anybody hold you accountable, right?
Nobody could have held me accountable. There was no way because everyone else is in the same boat, clueless.
Right.
And I was like, now I discovered that later on after I created the system, but I had to go through these cognitive dissonant moments of, you know, thankfully I'm a good clinician and I do pay very close attention to my feelings. Mm-hmm. Now these things don't just come and I don't lash out at my clients, but I definitely felt that anger, that dissonance. And then home, I was like, okay, I'm feeling upset. Why? I shouldn't feel upset with my clients like this. What is going on with me? So I did a lot of writing and I did yoga to kind of help deepen body-mind connection. Mm-hmm. I realized, yeah, my gosh, I'm experiencing countertransference. I'm traumatized. These people are triggering me.
Yeah, for sure.
I was just like, oh my God, these white people are triggering me.
You're a human being. Really?
Yeah, a human being, right? And I'm just like, oh my gosh, right? And I go, I need to heal from my racial trauma because how can I help anybody when I can't help myself? Like if I don't get better, how can I possibly help these people? So then as I started coaching like April, May of 2018, and then in 6 months, I had done a little over 100 sessions. And in these 100 sessions, Jen, I came to realize there was a pattern to this behavior. Mm-hmm. But I had never read about it before.
Right.
And so I was like sitting there racking my brain, trying to put pieces together. Like, I don't know what this is. Like, I know it's a pattern, mm-hmm. but I don't know exactly what it is. So after racking my brain for like 3 weeks, and I mean like almost every single day for hours on end.
Oh, I mean, this was
scientists like in their experimental thing, like putting things together and like doing mathematical formulas. I mean, I had a whiteboard. I was just trying to understand this pattern that I've sensed in my heart. Like, what is going on here? Mm-hmm. And so I started going, well, this is very much like a defense mechanism that's happening here. So I reviewed like the list of defense mechanisms with Freud and everything and psychodynamic theory, but I'm looking at it's like a hybrid. It's like, it's not just a defense mechanism. Hmm. It's a racist defense mechanism.
Right.
And then I learned that there are such that racist defense mechanisms were not a new term, but it wasn't talked about enough. But it wasn't just a defense mechanism. It was a racist defense mechanism, but these patterns I was seeing wasn't really reflecting what I had even seen online. So in my mind, what I had to do was I had to go on my whiteboard. And I had to think of all those 100 plus sessions and literally in my mind do like a Rolodex database dump. And I had to think about every single client I had and what they were doing and the scenarios. And I finally like, so I did that and I looked at the whiteboard and I go, so then I needed to test it. Obviously, I couldn't just go, oh, on myself, because I could be, you know, compromised in my viewpoints. I had no intention in any of this. It's like walking in a door number two, door number three, door number 10, and you're seeing like it goes deeper and deeper and deeper. And then you finally come up. It's like when you see a scientist and they come up with the aha moment.
Right.
The solution. And it's like, wow. Oh my gosh. And I'm not going to lie. I mean, after I was in shock actually. And after about an hour or two after the shock, I just started breaking down crying. Why? Tears of joy and happiness that I found the solution. Like I was just so, so, so happy. I mean, I was just sitting there going, and then I go, okay, April, stop it. Like you're happy, but this still has to be tested. And I was like, we need to test this on people. We need to go through trial runs. So I had my clients that I had worked with on an hourly basis. And I said, hey, I created this system, this like method, and I want to know, I know we've worked together and I know that I haven't really helped you enough and I'm sorry. And I apologized to every one of them that was willing to come back to me. And I said, I failed you, you know, like you came to me for help and I did the best that I could, but I wasn't able to get you what you needed. But I think I have now. Would you be willing to let me coach you one more time? Would you like to work with me on an hourly rate? But let's do this thing that I've just invented. And so I would say about a quarter of those people, so three quarters of people not coming back, about a quarter of them came back to me, which was fantastic. And I was like, cool. So they trusted me this quarter, like really. And I could totally understand why the three quarters didn't want to come back to me, because I hadn't delivered what I said I was going to deliver. And but the quarter kind of, there was something in them instinctually that felt, I think April could do this. And they've told me that. They're like, we knew that you would come up with something. Mm-hmm. I trust you. And I said, okay, cool. So they let me be, they were my guinea pigs, for That's a lack awesome. Of better words.
Yeah.
And they were making incredible progress. And I was just like, oh my God, I have to create a course on this.
That's
like,
awesome.
Good. Like, I got to do something about this.
Right.
And that's how I came to the work. That's how it led up to me starting to coach people in November of 2018.
Wow.
It all happened very rapidly.
Yeah.
Very.
Yeah. In a sense, though, right? Because your life has been working to this point. And your life experience, your profession, all of these things have been working to this point. It sounds like that key that unlocked the door, just like, bam, the door opened and all of this came through.
Yeah.
So tell me then about the program, because for people who are listening, who are interested, how do you find out about your program?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the best thing I could say first. So now, you know, had you interviewed me last year, it would have been different. Now I can really, after two batches, and now I've got my third one that I'm doing right now, that just got started. You're coming to me at a good time. Awesome. I can really give you some juicy, really good quality tested, you know, triple tested information here.
Yeah.
First of all, you got to be emotionally prepared, not because you're going to get tortured, but because there's, what I've learned is that there's kind of like situations that you're going to go through before you come to me. I'm sort of like the final, I'm at the end. So like what most white people kind of need to do that would help them is if they start getting educated and some awareness about what racism is and beginning to see a little bit of themselves in it. So I, in my mini ebook called The Path to Anti-Racism, I talk about the three steps. And actually, in the summer, I'm going to write my big, big book. But this is like a little mini ebook, little 19 pages. So awesome. The first step is really the awareness phase. So there's three phases. There's the awareness phase. And this, they really need to get in the awareness phase first, which is really like perhaps following these influencers, you know, reading books, like you're becoming aware that racism is a problem in society. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of getting very much out of your bubble, very much out of your comfort zone. And this is, you're gaining awareness. But see, what I learned through doing this work is that you see, you know, I just told you that whole story, right? Well, what most white people do and what is taught is just staying within this awareness phase. That's it. Like, that's why there was no solution. It was just awareness. Well, I know this. Okay.
Right.
That, I know this. So I don't understand why I'm still reacting in racist ways. Why am I still, you know what I'm saying? So then the next step would be the intervention, and that would be working. That's the intervention. So the intervention is actually getting working with someone one-on-one, working with somebody in a group. Now here's where we get into the quality of it. So this is something I learned earlier this year and the end of last year. And it was also another hit of cognitive dissonance. I learned that most people in the anti-racism world actually teach performative allyship. But back to all the stages, right? So it's like at that point, when a white person is getting an intervention, then they have to know, well, if I do get an intervention, invest. Because first they have to make an investment into awareness, and then they need to make an investment into an intervention. But then it's like, but what kind of intervention am I going to get? Well, here's the juicy part. And this is what I've learned in the work that I've done, how my work differs. And not because I'm like, yeah, look at me, I'm different, but it just is, Jen. It just is. And the thing is that when a white person chooses an intervention, they're either going to choose one where they're going to get punished, or they're going to do like the type of work that I do, which I can tell you has never been ever labeled like this, which is rehabilitation and reform. And so they are either going to get, for the most part, chastised, or they're going to actually reform. So I had the courage to go deep within myself to do my own shadow work, to see where I have been the victim of racism. And now I, in other words, am I going to, the shadow work is, am I going to become the perpetrator to these white people because I haven't healed from my own racial trauma? And so that's where I had to do that shadow work. And that emotional shadow work is actually what also led up to those, to my system. The system is what came of my healing. It, my healing birthed the system.
Right.
And so, and there's lots of people in this world who are quite frankly, quite famous that they create things because it's coming from a place of healing. Yeah. And I very much believe that in the future, my work is going to be pretty, like, in time before I die, pretty, it's going to be well off. It's going to be good. And it's going to do a lot of good in this world. What I will tell you is, and I know that a lot of in listening to you, you know, oh, there's different strokes for different folks. What I can tell you is through experience, you know, and take it or leave it. Through experience, it really comes down to, does it work or doesn't it work?
Yeah.
And so what does it work or doesn't it work? And so I remember back to that white person that asked me, well, you know, I'm not really getting better.
Right.
In the world of anti-racism, what most people, what most POC and whites teach is performative allyship. And you'll know it's performative allyship because if it fits one of the seven racist signatures in my system, then it's a defense mechanism. That's how I'm able to distinguish, are you healed or not healed? If you're teaching performative allyship, you're not coming from a place of healing. If you are teaching authenticity and vulnerability, and you're basically throwing out all the conditions,
yes,
it's simply teaching love, which isn't that what we want in this world?
Yes. And a lot of what you say reminds me so much of also Brené Brown, because you talk a lot about vulnerability.
She was my professor in college.
Oh, seriously amazing. But you talk about vulnerability and shame, and these are things that deeply resonate with me.
Yeah.
I mean, Brené Brown's book, The Gifts of Imperfection, quite literally changed my life. Like, literally.
Oh, yeah. That's what I'm in the business of doing. That's what I do with all these people.
I love it. I love it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's the book that I'll be writing, my version of The Gifts of Imperfection in
the
summer.
That's so cool.
That's kind of like, I call it like the version of, I guess you could say it's sort of like Marie Kondo. It's like the Spark Joy book, that the main, like the flagship book. That's what I'm writing this summer.
That's awesome.
It's going to be called The Racist Signature Method, and all of my, the 42 racist signature patterns I'm going to have reflect. I mean, it's going to be beautiful. It's going to be its own little system within that book, and people will be able to engage in it throughout the world. That's my goal, is to really get that book out there in hardback, paperback, on Kindle, and for it to be the main thing, you know, and to change the world through these books. And the beautiful thing is that I don't have to guess it's going to work. I've seen it consistently work with every single one of my clients in coaching, so long as that they are fully invested and engaged. They and do their homework. They always, almost always do well.
Yeah. No, this is awesome too, because I think about shame, right? And the role that it plays in shutting people down. You can only go so deep. And for me, like, I look around and we live in this broken world that has all of this trauma and all of this segregation and racism. And if we're not able to step into the reality of that and look it in the eyes and deal with it, and then we're not going to be able to heal from it, right? And so the fact that you're doing this work and that you've put together this program for people to be able to step in and just look at it and deal with the reality is huge.
It is huge. And it's huge. And you were asking me earlier about what it takes, right?
Yeah.
So it's awareness, the intervention, and then I call it the maintenance phase, but eventually I'm going to call it the resistance phase. But even before we go into all those three steps that we just went through, and I'll elaborate on the resistance phase, but even before we get into all that, let's look at the pre-work. Like I said, what kind of, even before you get into the awareness phase, emotionally, where do you need to be at?
Mm-hmm.
What does it take for a white person to actually get involved in anti-racism legitimately? And I'm going to tell you, because this happens almost every single time.
Awesome.
And I mean like legit, like not just trendy Black Lives Matter want to have a title. I mean like legit want to dive deep, 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 and eventually all the way to my coaching. It has to do with love, and it has to do with relationships. You got to have interracial relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Got every single one of my coaching clients is in an intimate interracial relationship. And so it actually, if you want to know why a lot of white people don't get involved in my coaching, for example, even if they wanted to go in droves, I only take 10 max, but, why I'm not, for example, on Instagram, like 125,000 followers. Why? Because the work is so deep, and because most white folks are not ready for that level of work. Because the truth is, in America and throughout the world, most white people do not have really, really, and I'm talking really intimate relationships with POC.
Right. Like the ride or die friends, right?
Ride or die. That's right. Yep. They don't. And they're in white circles talking about racism academically, and they don't, they really don't have anything at stake.
Yeah.
So if you don't have interracial relationships that are deep, that mean everything to you, that you, these people that come, let me tell you about these beautiful people that come to me for coaching. Let me tell you, they've been through hell. We're talking white people that have best friends that are POC. They have children that are POC. They, even if let's say that they don't have family that are POC, they work intimately in the healing professions with POC. Mm-hmm. And so intimacy too. So love and intimacy. Are you truly intimate, whether that be romantic friendship, coworker, colleague, client? Do you have an intimate relationship with POC that stirs love in your heart, where you're like, I do not want to be the cause of their pain and suffering. I want to get it right and be responsible for my behavior. Well, if you don't have those kind of relationships, and pretty much everything else in your life is going pretty well, like you have the, you know, white picket fence, and you have the nice car, and you have the kids and all that, and everything goes hunky-dory in your white neighborhood, everything's good and dandy, and you haven't really had very many intimate relationships with POC, well, you're not going to really care.
Right.
And so that's very hard for people to swallow. Like, they just don't care enough, not because they're so evil, but because they just don't have the relationships where the investment is there. If they're not invested legit deep, they're not going to go that deep. So essentially what happens in America throughout the world, you see a lot of white people and they read about the stuff, but that's about as far as they get. They just don't. And that in our society is deemed acceptable.
Well, it's designed that way, right? Because I can't tell you how many people I've talked to who say, I don't even live around people of color. Okay. I don't even work around people of color. I don't have these opportunities to connect with people of color. And for a vast part of this country, that is still shockingly true.
That is true.
I moved my white family into a predominantly black neighborhood. And until then, and until I started developing those ride or die friendships, all of it was just, it was theoretical. It was emotional. It was performative. It was, you know, any host of adjectives there. But yeah, that resonates so much.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And that can relate to so many things. I mean, you're just not, when it's personal, it's like growing up, I remember I was thinking, man, you know, all these people in my neighborhood, like there was a great analogy, like traffic signs or like, you know what I mean? Like situations on the road where how many deaths have to happen?
Right.
Before we like do something. Well, it doesn't happen until it's you.
Yeah.
And that's when people care, is when it's personal. And that's just humanity. I mean, that's normal. That's normal. Sure. So when white people say we never had the opportunity to move into a POC neighborhood, I'm going to say that's not true.
Right.
What it is, and that's why I say the pre-work is developing the courage. Because I bet you, before you moved into that mostly, you know, predominantly black community, I bet you and your spouse, you know, I bet that y'all really did a lot of soul searching emotionally. I mean, you had to go through all this stuff to develop the courage to integrate. That requires a lot of emotional work, actually, even before you do the next stage of work.
Sure.
So, you know what I mean? So it's like, it is that point of how much do I love humanity? How much do I love these people? How much do I want to? And then you go, you make a decision. These people matter to me. I love them and I need to move forward. And this is like a huge shift. And for most white people, they get their love from other white people. So why would they need to care about POC? That's just the fact. It's like saying, why would a Christian care about a Muslim? Why would a gay person care about a straight person? Why would a straight person care about a gay person? Because they're in two different worlds. But yeah, they're all human beings. They're all human beings. They all have feelings and they all they all just really want to be happy and live a life. I mean, that's what they want, right? They want relationships, healthy relationships, you know, in a nonviolent space, in a secure space with peaceful nonviolence for the most part. People want, they want safety. And so when you talk about the system, I've thought about that in such incredible depth. And, you know, like, it's like, what came first, you know, the chicken or the egg, you know, the systemic racism or, you know, institutional racism, or, you know, the individual. And I will tell you right now, it's the individual. Yeah. What it is that society is, it's a collective of individuals that, and it comes down to power and perceived power. And this is really kind of going back to my old professor, Brené Brown, back when we were in college, back in the day, she'd say, but what is power? Is power one way or is it shared? Is it distributed equally? How is power set up? And so with institutional racism, you have a bunch of individuals that essentially are narcissists and they get away, they get to institutions of power. And so we're talking very narcissistic people at the apex of power. Well, that's because we live in a world full of violence and racism is just one of the many, many nasty little shades of violence that human beings have created.
Right.
In order to divide and conquer. And it's unfortunate. And what it does is it holds us back. I truly even believe it holds us back in scientific progress and in all forms of like progress, like in the whole world, you know?
I do too. Yeah.
Really holds us back. So when we wonder how come we don't have the cure for this, or how come we are not, you know, letting go of poverty, why do we have so many societal problems? Well, because we haven't, you know, we haven't learned how to stop being violent. Until the white person comes to the realization too, so that'd be point number three, that I'm actually not a morally upstanding person if I don't do anti-racism. See, what most white people think is I'm just a perfectly good person.
Yes.
If I don't do anti-racism, because look at everything around me is all hunky-dory. It's like,
yeah,
actually it's not. And it actually has affected you to be a violent person. You just don't know it. You just don't know it. And that was what I would call racist denial in my system. So that's actually the most difficult one in the racist signatures, which are the core seven, are racist denial. Now let's moving forward to, yeah, so essentially the whole country is, most of the white people in the country are in a state of racist denial. That's why we haven't, that's why you could even say, you know, you could even say like queer denial, racist denial, sex denial, they're all in denial because these are narcissistic tendencies. These are all, again, if you do any kind of research about criminal activity in the criminal mind, it's absolutely tied into narcissism. So this is all criminal psychology. It's like it's also similar to alcoholism. You have to, like, how do you maintain sobriety? How do you maintain, how do you not go back into that?
Right. Right. Well, we've been trained, you know, so it's like for me being 42 and I've been spending probably the last 3 to 5 years really heavily deconstructing. But there are those moments where I slide back into certain things. Like the other day, for example, I posted a friend of mine who's also a contributor on the podcast. She is a Muslim woman and her mosque was under harassment and it was terrifying. Mm-hmm. She shared a picture as well as a plea for, you know, just like help to get the word out about it. And I shared it on Instagram. And immediately I had people come on saying, like, this is very triggering and this isn't something that I want to see, you know, and challenging me. And I realized in that moment, it was like, I felt like I was doing the right thing. And I felt like I was honoring my friend's request and I was indignant and I was outraged and I wanted people to see so that they could learn, you know, but I didn't put it together in a way that was also following up with, let's say, step by step actions that people could take, for example.
So can I tell you, if you're okay, can I coach you real quick?
Yeah, yeah.
Can I coach you?
Yeah.
Can you open it for a second?
Totally.
So that one would be what I call a 7-3. So the 42 racist signatures actually reflect the 7. But when you multiply them into the little box, they become 42. So what happens is that externally, you went into what I call racist leadership, which is, it really is like the utmost performative allyship. And it doesn't mean that you can't like lead anti-racism in the future. It doesn't mean that. What it means is that you've got to do some work. Now, that in that scenario, case scenario, externally you reacted to the racial trigger. So let me break this down for you, good baby coach.
Right.
Like there was a racial trigger. The racial trigger is your buddy.
Right.
Your buddy came to you and they were the victim of racial trauma, as was this person's mosque. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now you reacted to that racial trigger by externally in your racist defense mechanism was into racist leadership, right? So right. Remember what I said with mine, with my trauma, what did I go straight into activism, right? Because yep. that was a trauma response of defense mechanism, right? So you right. went into a perpetrator defense mechanism. Then it was driven by a 3, which is saviorism. So you perpetrated a 7-3. Mm-hmm. And the core was likely shame, because the shame drives the saviorism and the saviorism drives the advocacy. So yeah. this is how that would work. So my clients learn how, you know, how POC are like, y'all need to Google this up and catch yourself. You need to catch yourself.
Right.
That's a situation where you would eventually learn to catch yourself and not have to be told. Like you right. just catch it. And it's not in a performative way. Like here's the rules of anti-racism, but like, what is that all about? And so, but here's what I'm going to tell you about that. This can feel very conflicting because a 7-3 racist leadership can appear like it can POC actually love the 7-3. They mm-hmm. love it. They'll eat up for breakfast, lunch and dinner. Oh, you get us. Like, look at you putting your neck out there. But that's a rule of anti-racism, which is white person, you need, the rule is if you care about us, if you like us, if you want to be part of the club, you need to perform.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so it is actually unhealthy for any POC, and this totally breaks the rules for all this listening. People are like, what? It actually is inappropriate for a POC to expect any white person to step in. And this is not to say that a white person can't ever step in, but if a white person steps in and they haven't actually like done that deeper work, it's going to be surface. But POC, you know what? We've gotten so used to surface that we're grateful we even get surface.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
We are grateful that we even get surface. It's kind of like in domestic violence when you have to bear with me, I'm going to my feminist therapy mode. So it's kind of like with domestic violence, when a person has been the victim of domestic violence and they're like, well, you know, he yells at me, but at least he doesn't hit me.
Right.
See, so POC are grateful for any little breadcrumbs that they get a lot of the time.
Right. Well, and the shame, the point you make about the shame is huge mm-hmm. for me, because for me, within the context of anti-Black white supremacy, I've been doing a lot of work for a very long time, and I would never post something like that. But I have only begun to step into the role that I have played in Islamophobia. And so I do have this shame. And I was definitely yeah. coming from that place where it was like, all right, rally the troops. Let's do, you know, and like, and it
yeah,
just
I
was
understand.
Like,
my
wow.
level. Now, what's happening is that when we understand, like, this is like philanthropy. It's like, are you doing it for them? Or are you doing it for yourself? So right. this is like when, as a, all of my white clients, what they start to find out with their saviorism, for the most part, is that when they feel they have to jump, it's because there's something inside of themselves where they feel disempowered. So, because when you think about it. Does that POC have the power to protect themselves? Do they have the power? We are taught in the discourse that POC don't have enough power, and that's why white people need to step in. But the reality is that they actually do have power to advocate for themselves or set boundaries and all right. that other good. They actually can have a better life if they heal from their racial trauma. So white people can't save POC. POC have to save themselves.
Right.
And that's talked about, for example, a lot in Pan-Africanism. Like, I didn't get that from Pan-Africanism, but just for those that listen, if you're familiar with Pan-Africanism, that's yeah. why, like, Haile Selassie and all these people, because they're like, you need to save yourself. Yeah. You need to advocate for yourself. Stop asking white people to save you. And then white people get in this thing where they're like, oh no, the poor POC, we have institutional racism, so therefore they're totally helpless and they could never help themselves. Well, at one point it was like that. And this is not to say that the love is not there, because saviorism, I call it a tricky beast, because it's usually a mix between empathy, love, and narcissism. It's very complex. So what my clients do is that they purify that and extrapolate out that narcissism, and all that's left is love and empathy.
Yeah.
So in other words, they heal on the inside so that the narcissism stops, because narcissism is, you got something in, there's something inside that needs to be fixed. And so what they find that out. So most white people, they don't know that that's something that needs to be fixed. And again, that racist denial will prevent them. So that's why my clients, when they finish my program, that's why they get better, because they do get healing on the inside. But they need to know what they need to heal and why, right, to be able to connect their own personal trauma with the racism. So we get into all that together in coaching in those 7 weeks. Like, what is the trauma that's driving my saviorism? What happened to me?
Right.
You know,
that's amazing.
What happened to me when I was a kid? Or was my, for perfectionism, a lot of my clients, you guess where the perfectionists, they got one of their parents. It was very hard on them.
Right.
Very hard on them. So yeah. It's like, you know, they, and sometimes not, sometimes when they're kids, they're just really hard on themselves and they make a decision. I'm going to be hard on myself for the rest of my life, you know, and that's what that, all that stuff drives the racism. So once you nip that in the bud, the racism is gone. It's gone. There's not, yeah, the core feelings, these core toxic feelings no longer drive it. So it's a grieving process, because you're letting go of performative allyship, getting real vulnerability. And so then when they're done with the program, it's like, it's almost like they're starting their relationships with POC from scratch.
We don't need to be scared of each other. We don't need to be afraid of messing up. We don't need to be afraid of saying the wrong things. We need to understand we are going to say the wrong things because of the fact that we are products of this environment.
Yes.
Right. And so being able to step into this space with people and just be real and be who we are and be open and be vulnerable and not letting shame be the thing that guides us and dictates us, and being open to seeing when that is the case, I think is so transformative.
It's very transformative. But for people to, I think that white people, they feel more comfortable getting into that when it's not a racial trigger.
Yeah.
The key. So for example, there's lots of white folks in America who love Brené Brown. And I love Brené Brown. She's awesome. I mean, she was my professor.
Right.
But notice how there's more followers of Brené Brown than doing this type of work. Right. And the reason is because it's a racial trigger. Why?
Yes.
Because it's really taboo. It's really taboo. So it's very hard for white people to face that taboo and to do that deeper work. That's why I say, The pre-work to get there is a lot of what I do on Instagram, is really to teach and help people connect the dots. And before, it used to be where the only way people could work with me is if they had the means to do it. And now it's like I have this network, $24.99. I mean, now it's like they get a coaching once a month. Accessibility definitely wasn't there, but now it's there. And as of right now that we're chatting, I've got 65 members. So that's, you know,
that's awesome.
Yeah. But mind you, subtraction wise, 17 or 18 of them are alumni, but still 65 is great. And considering that I just started it March, 2019, not bad.
Yeah. You know, well, and hopefully people who are listening to this are going to join. How do people sign up for this?
So what you do is, if you're on Instagram, you would just, go to my link in the bio. But if you just want to go straight to my website, it would be www.aprilharder.com. And I'd say straight up, Jen, start with the network, because you get your toe in the water. Just get a little taste, and the great thing is that the first 7 days are free. I am all for good deals, and I am all for let me try this. And then if I like it, cool. If I don't, I can bounce out. So the first 7 days are free in the network. But if you just want to go directly to the network, you're like, well, I just want to start the network right now. You would go to racistsignature.com. So whether you get it from aprilharder.com or racistsignature.com, either way you can get to the network. That's where I would say you probably would want to start first. And you can actually get a lot of awareness phase information just within that network. And I didn't say this yet, but that's also a reason why I wanted to start the network. I wanted to create my own version of awareness phase, because most of the awareness work, when I first started this work, I just was doing intervention and helping people develop their resistance plans, obviously. So the racistsignature.com website where the network is the place where you would do your awareness work.
Awesome. And what is your Instagram handle?
Yeah, it's April Harder, LCSW.
And how do you spell Harder?
Yeah,
just it's for people.
So it'd be H-A-R-T-E-R. So the handle in full would be April and then H-A-R-T-E-R-L-C-S-W.
Awesome. So people can look for you there, check out your website, sign up for the 7-day free trial, or just go straight into the network. Thank you so much for coming and talking to us. And anytime you want to come back, we would love to have you.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.